You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong toku ingoa, no mai haramai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāmere, Friday the 2nd of August. My name is Justin and I'm filling in as your host today because Laura's feeling a little bit under the weather. But still, don't worry, because your regular Friday crew is still sticking around because I'm joined in the studio by Ben Goldson. How are you today?
I'm alright, yes. They'll never get rid of me. I'm going to chain myself to the station.
And in the studio?
Yes, the studio as well. Sorry. I'm sort of sick as well.
Everyone's sick, by the way. Maybe it's just because of the cold and because it's raining.
Plus, I have been spitting in people's food around the station.
That's why everyone's sick. Damn you, Ben. Anyway, Whai Akene coming up on the show today. National Party's Denise Lee will be joining us shortly. Lillian Henley speaks with Helen Kelly, together filmmaker Tony Sutorius, about the last year of the unionist's life. And in Neutral Corner, Ben is talking about the current situation in the Gulf of Oman. And finally, in this day of history, Ben is taking us to South Vietnam in 1964. As always, he aha o whakaro. Get in touch with us with any thoughts you have. Tuka pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395. Or why am I? Give us a call in studio on 309 3879.
Hang about. It's our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Denise Lee.
Hi Denise, kia ora, how are you doing today?
Hey, good Justin, but not so good to hear Laura's a bit under the weather. So
yeah,
I'm
I know.
Sure if she can be, she'll be listening in, and this is a big shout-out, Laura. We hope you get well soon. But it's
get
great
well
to
soon,
you,
Laura.
Justin.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll be joining us today at, on air. But yeah, how was your week?
Yeah, no, it's been good. It's been quite busy, Justin. So as you know, we had a parliamentary recess. Doesn't mean it's 3 weeks off. It just means Parliament wasn't sitting for 3 weeks, mm-hmm. and now we're back in it. Mm-hmm. So when you get down to Wellington, they're very long days. It's like school. We're not allowed to leave the campus, the Parliament grounds until the bell rings, and we're there and the Parliament sits, the debating chamber, till 10 o'clock at night. Mm. So they're long days, but they're good, and we've got loads of issues going on.
Right, and I can also see that the National Party had a party conference at Christchurch last weekend. Did you go there?
Yep, sure did. So that's
how was
our
it?
Annual conference where all the electorates come in, they're pretty big affairs for all political parties, but we've got 55 MPs, the biggest team in Parliament by a long shot. So then you've got 55 lots of MPs and electorate mm-hmm. teams all fired up. It was a good one. We announced that extra $200 million for cancer drug treatment, mm-hmm. And that came over. That was very well received by the public, so all our social media posts went like wildfire.
Right, I see. Okay, let's get into it. Then, what are your personal thoughts, on your leader Simon Bridges' comments that the Prime Minister is, quote, a part-time Prime Minister?
Well, it's really important for us as opposition to hold the government to account, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. legally what our role is. So, holding the government and the Prime Minister to account, if that's what we've got to do, then there are some comments that need to be made. And in this context, remember I just said to you earlier that we have just mm-hmm. come off the back of a 3 week recess. Mm-hmm. So the comments around the Prime Minister and her trip to Tokelau was wondering why she didn't go during that 3 week recess. And instead what we've had this week in the House is not only her gone, but also the Deputy Prime Minister gone. Mm-hmm. Also the Acting Prime Minister was even gone mm-hmm. For one of the question times this week. So we're now down to the fourth in line. And we're saying, hey, massive issues going on in New Zealand at the moment, protesting around Oranga Tamariki and issues there. People are saying that Te Mātou is the new bastion point or the new foreshore and seabed crisis. Mm-hmm. These are big, tricky issues. And it would be really great not to just only have the Prime Minister here, for us not to get down to the fourth in line during question time. Stack up.
Well, if you were the PM, what would you do? Would you go to Ihumātau or Tokelau?
Well, I'm not the Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. I certainly would have looked at Tokelau during the three-week recess. I know and will acknowledge that it is a very long trip to get there, 22 hours on the boat or something like that. But, hey, three-week recess, Parliament wasn't even going then. Parliament's going now. She should be in Parliament fronting up for question time. It is the 1 hour of the day when Parliament's sitting that we hold on behalf of the public, the government, to account. Ministers, prime ministers have to answer the questions of the day.
Right, but because we were on the subject of Ihumātau, what are your thoughts on that? And did you think the Prime Minister made a correct decision last Friday when she said nothing, no construction will begin in Ihumātau before there's a consensus?
Yeah, look, we're very cautious on this particular topic. It's incredibly complicated. I was a councillor, Justin, and have been through some rounds of whether it be developed and consenting and so on. It is so complex. Look, quite frankly, I think the Prime Minister should be in New Zealand dealing with this, and I would be very cautious about wading into that. I mean, picking up on Winston Peters suggesting that the government should buy the land. I mean, that's another whole direction. It feels very confused and complicated, but clearly the Fletchers and Iwi have got a lot to wade through, and the government should tread very carefully.
Right. Now, moving on to another topic. The government yesterday has announced it will group 16 polytechnic. Their plan to group 16 polytechnics into one big organisation. What is National's position regarding on that?
So one mega polytech is by far the biggest shake-up in at least 25 years. We say it will cost at least 1,300 jobs. Some polytechs will likely close. I mean, they're saying that themselves. And we've got no decisions made about how this whole big, gigantic monolith is going to be funded. So it sounds like a recipe for disaster. Right. We've got employers telling us that they're going to stop employing apprentices because now the apprentices don't train on the job. They train at the mega polytech. Look, Justin, I feel like it's a real paternalistic approach to things. The government has met on this, consulted on this, didn't listen to what industry and definitely not what the politics were saying, and boom, we've got a giant mega outcome, and it's not at all nuanced for the regions. It loses jobs. It puts in jeopardy things like the international student market. It does not stack up, and we're strongly opposed to it.
Right. But some polytechnics have already said they will support the government's changes because it will be more beneficial for students and it gives the administration flexibility to meet demands. What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, no doubt out of 16 polytechs, there'll be some for which you know, a rejigging helps them out. And, you know, look, by anyone's measuring stick, there's always a need to have a look at how things are working and tweak where necessary. But this is a massive seismic shift. And when you've got at least 1,300 jobs going, South Island Institute of Technology, Southern Institute of Technology and Otago Polytech, they are absolutely opposed to this. And just between those two alone, you've got hundreds of jobs lost and a real dire situation for what they think is, you know, a stripping away, a paternalistic stripping away from the regions. It doesn't make sense. It's all about control and centralised control.
Then what would Nationals' plan be?
Well, definitely empower the regions to make their own calls and make their own decisions about what and where and how they teach. And then also return back. So if this is going to happen, and they've said that it is, we'll give back Polytech's assets that Labor are about to take away from them, because a lot of these assets, well, in fact, all of them are owned and nurtured by the communities. Just think Southern, you know, SIT, and how careful they are about what they own and how they own it and how they fundraise for it and got it. And then we'll also return apprenticeships and training of apprenticeships back to industry. At the end of the day, industry knows what's best for industry.
Right. And how is this beneficial to future students or the polytechnics themselves?
So how's what beneficial, Justin? What I've just said about what National will do?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, look, massively, because like I said, it's by industry, for industry. We're saying that the regions know what's best, not one big, giant, centralised mothership that actually cans, nixes 1,300 jobs. We all know that jobs in regions and just every single one of those jobs are vital for a local economy. So how it's going to benefit is basically backing the regions, not slamming them.
Right. And going finally, we all recently know the government has put a referendum frameworks bill in Parliament recently, outlining the format of the upcoming referendum for recreation, for legalising cannabis. So what position is National taking on that?
Well, you've got a really interesting scenario here, Justin. Labor, when we had our flag referendum, and we all remember that, were hell-bent on making sure that the wording and that the referendum itself would be determined by Parliament. They wanted to be part of the decision-making. They said that the public have to have their say during the select committee process. And now they're saying the complete opposite. They're bending the rules for and about to do the complete opposite. This is a bill that controls how, what the issues are and what the questions are that will be put to the public next year at the 2020 election. And they, the bill says that it's Cabinet that decides that. So it's a complete reversal, and all we can say, or all we can see, is that this is just made to accommodate the demands of the minor parties. So you've got the juggling, the jiggling between New Zealand First and the Greens and Labor around issues like, you know, cannabis and euthanasia and so on. And because it's going to be so difficult for them to decide, all of a sudden they're deciding behind closed doors in Cabinet. And we say this is complete exit from what we've ever done. As a Parliament, we debate this stuff, and they're taking it off to closed doors in Cabinet, and that's actually sneaky.
Right, but the Justice Minister, Andrew Little, says National is exaggerating by saying this bill is undemocratic because there is no set procedure for setting referendum questions. So, yeah, what is your response to that?
Well, there is procedure. It's called convention. We've always done it together as a Parliament, and they are completely flying in the face of that. And it's hypocritical to go hard out on the flag referendum with that same argument, and now they're doing the polar opposite. So, and if you want one more example of how sneaky this is, the bill isn't even permanent. That they're making all these little changes only apply to referendums next year. So if they back themselves and back their idea for doing all this by themselves behind closed doors, well, then why isn't this permanent? It's just for next year. It sniffs and smells something pretty dodgy.
But what do you think should the government have done?
Oh, done what we've always done, Justin, which is convention is make this bill say that the referendums and the devising of the issues and the questions on the referenda make that a parliamentary process. So that means you can go in, I'm an MP, but members of the public can go in, you can have your say on what that question is on cannabis, and your say on what you think that the euthanasia, should that pass, the euthanasia question looks like. So the public's just getting completely cut out.
Right, then I think that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Denise, and hopefully...
Hey, you're welcome.
Yeah, hopefully Laura will be well enough back to talk to you again next week.
No, pleasure to talk with you, Justin. You've done well. And one more time, shout out Laura. Get better soon.
Shout out to Laura. Okay, thanks.
See you, Justin.
See ya.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The National Party's Denise Lee on 95BFM. Red Bull and Laneway Festival have joined forces once again to present a very special showcase of music in Auckland this August. Featuring hotly tipped Australian art rock outfit Methyl Ethyl, performing alongside fast-rising local indie bands Daffodils and Stink. This show will make for a unique opportunity to check out three heavy-hitting bands all at once at Galatos on Saturday, August 3rd. RSVP now through redbull.com/music for $10 tickets on the door. R18.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
So we just had some texts came in regarding the National Party, and it says, quote, when they were in power, they neglected every complex social issue under the sun. Now, all of a sudden, they have a social conscience. They had 9 years to make progress, yet all they managed to accomplish was a shacked housing market and a $26 million flag referendum that nobody wanted in the first place. And now, up next, Helen Kelly together is a film screening in this year's New Zealand International Film Festival. Helen Kelly is perhaps best described as a unionist and a friend. She was well known for her work with the Pike River Mine families, as well as fighting for justice for those who lost family members in workplace accidents. Later in her life, she also became an accidental advocate for medicinal cannabis. Director Tony Sartorius was given access to Helen in the last year of her life as she continued to do the work most important to her, as well as undergoing cancer treatment. Lillian Henley spoke with Tony this morning and started by asking how he gained that access.
Well, I knew Helen. Not super close, but we'd known each other over the years. She was a fan of my film Campaign, which I made all back in the old days, back in 1999 that came out, about the first MMP election. And over the years, I'd kind of been on her list of people she rang up when she needed a favour, and, you know, we'd gotten to know each other a little bit. So I did know her and, you know, liked her. And when it came out how sick she was, which seemed hard to believe, given the sort of just the life energy that she always just threw out into the world, we talked about it a few times and found quite an interesting rapport somehow. You know, I'm a volunteer firefighter and have dealt with death a lot, I think, and so we ended up quite a frank, no bullshit kind of conversation about it, which you didn't get to have all that often, I suspect, and so we got to talk about it. So I went and sat down with her the very first day after she had finished working at the CTU. She was a bit anxious about not having a job, didn't really know what she was going to do. Didn't really know whether having a video camera filming her doing whatever that was going to be a good idea or not. Didn't know how long she'd live. But I said to her, look, why don't we give it a go? See if it seems like a good idea and just, you know, get started. So we did.
So in terms of you approaching that, and obviously this is a very It's not, I suppose, passion project's not the right word, right? But in the sense that you're...
Pretty grudges, actually.
Well, you're doing it, right? You're doing it in the sense that you know that it's right to do, but you also don't know what this story is going to look like. So how did you go into that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of documentary film talk, you know, makes it sound like they're kind of drama films that you kind of, you know, make up. Like your filmmaker starts out with it all figured out and then tries to cast it almost, you know? I don't believe in making documentaries like that. I don't think that's how they work, you know. I didn't quite know what the film was about, but I knew that Helen was an important and interesting person, and there were some things about her that I really wanted to understand better and wanted to be able to get to the bottom of and share with people. That was my starting point.
Mm. So who is Helen Kelly?
Well, okay, so Helen had a pretty unusual upbringing. Her dad was Pat Kelly, who was a very prominent... you know, one of those famous kind of British-accented, stroppy militant unionists from the 60s and 70s. He was also a communist, as was her mother. Her mother came from a much more affluent, middle-class background. Like her great-great-great-grandfather was the first judge in New Zealand and, you know, from the Eichelbaums and so on and so on. So she had this interesting kind of very poor Liverpudlian left-wing father and a quite kind of... sort of, you know, lefty, quite affluent mother, and they, that's who they were. They were famous in New Zealand. They were arch rivals of Rob Muldoon, and her dad was quite likely a prime candidate of the Trades Hall bombing in 1984, which very nearly killed him and did kill his very close friend and Helen's mate, Ernie Abbott. So, you know, she came up through that turbulent time in the 70s, but whereas perhaps for most people that was a time of quite high engagement and commitment with social issues, it was quite life and death for the Kellys, you know, a bit more serious. So she had that in her background, and I had kind of imagined, a lot of people imagine that's where all her politics and all her social activism comes from, but my feeling is it's a little more subtle than that, because a lot of people had similar upbringings and didn't turn into Helen Kelly. I think what she really came out of that with most prominently of all was this very deep humanism. It's not even quite the right word. She would quite sincerely, everyone she engaged with anywhere, no matter what, would engage with as a full human being of equal standing. Everyone was as good as everyone else, and it didn't matter if it was a work thing or, you know, someone selling her a sandwich or, you know, the Prime Minister. It was all kind of the same. And New Zealanders think that's what we like, right? That's kind of, oh yeah, it's the Kiwi way. When you actually hang out with someone who actually is like that, you realise, nah, that's pretty unusual. And it's got very interesting implications for how you live your life. And I think it turned out that was sort of the answer to my question. That's who she was.
Mm. And was that the only question that you had, or were there other questions?
Actually, at a really surfacey level, the most interesting thing that drew me to Helen first was that when she would talk about political things or social issues or whatever, which she often did in public, she had an absolutely prodigious social media appetite. She had like 18,000 tweets in her last 5 years, something like that, just a ridiculous number. It never really sounded dry. It didn't sound like a policy position. It actually sounded like it was about people. And I just thought that was very interesting because it was very unusual. There's very few politicians or political public figures in New Zealand that sound like they're talking about people very often, and she always did. And I was very interested to know why that was the case or how that was the case. It seemed like more than just, you know, clever communications. There was something else going on. And there was, you know. I think actually the essence of it was simply that she had relationships with people from right across society, like real ones, you know, they were her mates. And she was engaged with their lives in a completely practical, real way, right through her life. And again, you go, oh, yeah, well, we're New Zealanders, that's what we're like. Well, yeah, it's not, you know, especially in Wellington.
And I want to touch on that, I guess, more, because like you say, we supposedly kind of have this idea of ourselves as being very friendly or being very, I don't know what the buddy-buddy or able to kind of engage with anybody, but actually you're right, there's a very particular skill or way of being that means that you can engage with anybody of any sort, you know, that she's engaging with people from, like you say, all walks of life, and there's quite a particular I think, I mean, there's obviously this real engagement with rural communities in this film.
Oh, totally.
Because that's who she is engaging yeah. with, and a totally different sort of socioeconomic status. And she's kind of able just to walk into, there's a part earlier in the film where one of your characters speaks to how she came in the first time she met this family.
Yeah.
And this woman expected her to maybe just talk about herself or how she's great or what she can do.
Yeah.
But she basically just engaged and
sat
created
on the floor
a relationship.
And played with her kids.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And what she was doing was creating relationships.
Well, the thing is, you know, it wasn't just that she had a good rapport with people. I mean, she did, but it wasn't just that. She actually just didn't have the boundary that prevented that from flowing into an ordinary relationship with people. They were her friends. She had friends, like actual friends, from all over the place in all kinds of circumstances alive in her life all the time. And that is unusual. That really is. I mean, how many politicians have mates who live on the minimum wage?
Mm.
I'd suggest it's pretty close to zero.
Yeah.
You know, even on the left. And that's actually has really important implications for our understanding of how the world works. She was very connected to the lived lives of working New Zealanders. I mean, very sincerely. Yeah.
And actually, the people that... Yeah, like you say, even in the left, those who are supposedly fighting for those people,
yeah,
what lived experience do they have of those lives?
Well, look, I mean, I'm not gonna say anything flash about myself. I mean, I'm you know, like a Wellington liberal, you know, like many others, and you know, we all have really top grade Facebook feeds. We're really right on, but how many of us actually are engaged in those worlds? You know, not many. And what really struck me about it wasn't so much that Helen was, it's just that I found it really arresting to realise that the rest of us weren't. It's not who we think we are. And actually for me, that's what the big business of this film is. It's really invites the audience to consider who we are now as New Zealand, and does the way we behave actually align with the values that we still kind of flatter ourselves that we have. Yeah,
that's brilliant. I almost want to leave it there, but I've got lots more to say.
So. Please go. Let's go.
I mean, throughout the sort of beginning of the film, there's it's quite light. I felt, and there's a very particular point where I feel that the death, I guess, becomes much more real, and there's kind of a change of a feel for me. Anyway, that's how I read it. So what you've just described is that kind of human element and an encouragement for New Zealanders to kind of even take that challenge on board.
Mm.
But is this film also about death?
Yeah. I mean, Helen dies in the film, and it's inevitable that was really, you know, that was part of what. You know, the journey of the film, but also she was dealing with death, you know. She was dealing with Pike River, she was dealing with families who'd lost men in forestry, she was dealing with what sincerely are life and death issues for tens of thousands of New Zealand families. And, you know, it's not so much that I wanted to make a film about dying, but I think that the context of dying creates a particular moral clarity around some of these issues. You know, we might argue or disagree about, you know, how resources should be distributed in society, but hopefully we would pretty much all agree that if your husband, usually husband, is killed at work, then there ought to be justice about that. You know, it ought to be treated as an important thing and there should be an investigation, and if somebody's stuffed up, then they ought to be prosecuted if it's against the law. But, you know, actually it became very clear making the film that that isn't what happens. It like almost not, well, nearly universally, but overwhelmingly, just straight out doesn't happen. There isn't any justice for many, many people. And why the hell not? It's actually really quite, I personally found it disturbing to see and reflect on the fact that that's missing, and that the fact that it's happening to the people that it's happening to don't even seem that surprised by that, because that aligns with a lot of their experience of our culture and society.
That part of the film was quite eye-opening for me, because I've never worked in a sort of forestry sector or any other of those other industries that even Helen describes them being very dangerous. And the process of watching that kind of court case and how very real those effects are on people, and then there not being any sort of justice
Well, I mean, you know, it's in the film, but for the period that Helen was particularly focusing on, there were 900 serious accidents in the forestry sector, including 50 or 60 deaths, and out of all of those, WorkSafe made 12 prosecutions. And all of the rest of the cases, basically they concluded that there was no case to answer. Nobody was responsible, there was no need to do anything else. I mean, think about that.
That's shocking.
Isn't it?
Like, it's a not even fathomable number.
We look at coal mine collapses and people die in China, and we tut, oh my God, how terrible. Happens here. And I think these men, I think all men, they're overwhelmingly men, who this happens to are poor, they're brown, and they're provincial, and it's considered normal. Even a WorkSafe inspector in the film describes it as the nature of the beast. You know, our forestry sector kills 7 times more people than the next most dangerous industry. In any given year, based on the last statistics I saw, out of 7,000 people in the industry, 1,000 will be on ACC because they've been injured at work. I mean, the numbers are just mind-boggling.
And then you go back to that attitude you're talking about. I mean, even the fact that they've said the nature of the beast, it's that same attitude as, oh, she'll be right.
Exactly. I mean, you know, one of the hardest things, I think, in a society is to look at something that's always, or been the case for a long time, and say, well, hang on a minute, what the hell, you know? It's almost like waking up from a sleep. There are things that we just simply accept and take for granted. You know, and Pike River is actually a rather similar and good example. I mean, it's changed now. But for a very long time, everybody nearly seemed to just think, oh, God, why don't they just get over it? Okay, so 29 people died, and okay, no one's been prosecuted, and oh, we haven't really quite recovered the bodies or the evidence, but time to move on. What the hell is that about?
And that was Tony Sartorius speaking with Lillian Henley, and the interview itself was much longer, so the full version will be online after the show. Helen Kelly, together, is playing this afternoon and on Sunday morning as part of the film festival. Tony will be at both screenings along with some of those people in the film to answer any questions. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, Marunga BFM. You are listening to The Wire on 95 BFM. And remember, you can text us on 5395 with your thoughts.
So around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
And now, what have you got for us at the Neutral Corner, Ben?
God, yes, the long-awaited return of Neutral Corner. This is about recent tensions in the Gulf of Oman, mainly between Iran and the United Kingdom, over various shipping. The UK seized the tanker from Iran, which claimed was smuggling oil. Iran seized a couple back in the Gulf of Oman, which has led to these tensions, which have been reported about first on Iran's state broadcaster, Press TV.
Like with my guest to the program, James Jatras, a former U.S. diplomat out of Washington, D.C., and Mike Billington, Asia Desk Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start this off with Mike in Leesburg. Mike, Iran says the British vessel turned off its transponder and did not respond to its requests. Why do you think a vessel would actually turn off its communication system and not expect to answer for such a violation and others?
Well, it's very clear that the British have carried out a series of provocations. I would respond to your opening statement that you should be very careful not to make the mistake that somehow the U.S. is drawing the British into this situation. It's quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. We're dealing here with a British leadership which is in total chaos and disarray internally, is now under direct attack from the Trump administration's attorney general, who is carrying out an investigation into the British MI6 GCHQ role in the attempted coup against President Trump. And they are closing in on the British role in this. The British are far more frightened of this than any incident in the Gulf. And their intent was to, in fact, provoke some sort of confrontation to try to draw the U.S. in, despite the fact that President Trump has repeated over and over again, we are not going to have a war with Iran, and nor does Iran want a war with the United States. It's the British who are desperately trying to provoke that war to break Trump from his commitment to no more regime change, and to his commitment to making a friendly relationship with Russia rather than the kind of warmongering operation that was run by the British, demonizing Russia and trying to drag the United States into a confrontation with Russia. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at this Iran situation in that global context. This is exactly why Mr. LaRouche is always warned. You have to start from the top down, looking at the continued role of the British Empire in frantically trying to prevent the United States from coming into agreement with Russia and China. And let me add, especially at this moment with the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo shot, where the entire world, Russia, China, India, Japan, South America, Brazil, all nations were celebrating this example of what man can achieve, especially if we join forces and work together. Okay. Frontiers of human knowledge.
All right, let me get James in on a discussion. James, what do you think about Mike's analysis of the situation?
I think there's a lot to what he says regarding the whole investigation into Russiagate and the British role in that. I think he's a bit more optimistic than I am that will come to fruition. Clearly, there are moves in that direction. Whether they will go anywhere remains to be seen. I think whatever the disarray is on the British side, having made a hash out of Brexit and the fight over the prime ministership with looks now Mr. Johnson going to succeed Prime Minister May, we have our own disarray here on the American side that that whatever Mr. Trump's hesitation about getting into another new war, and I agree that is his preference. Unfortunately, he has saddled himself with the team, starting with National Security Advisor John Bolton, but also I would say Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Well, let me just jump in here right here, James. Let me just jump in here because both you and Mike are saying similar things. But
yes, that was Press TV's The Debate on the recent tensions in the Gulf of Oman. As you heard there, it was obviously quite pro-Iran side of the story, which I think is to be expected. What is quite interesting is the two experts they brought in, quote-unquote experts. Mm-hmm. So the first one, Mike Billington, he is a member of the LaRouche movement, if you've heard of that. Is this weird... They sort of emerged out of the American New Left of the 1960s and then swung very hard to the right in the 1970s and 80s. And one of their big things... really their biggest thing is that like the world is controlled by the Queen of England. She's the world's biggest drug dealer, and they have this strangely close relationship with Press TV. So that's obviously informed his take on these tensions, that it's, you know, the puppet master, the Queen of England, 90 whatever year old woman pulling all the strings. And the other one, James George Dutras, is a former State Department official who then left to go work as a private lobbyist. And again, he's one of these strange figures who I was sort of looking him up online, and most of his things seem to be about like the decline of traditional values and all these sort of things. And interestingly, one other thing he'd written was about in the aftermath of the Christchurch terror attack, saying, oh, they're just going to, you know, accuse everyone of being a racist and blah, blah, blah. Which then I find it's quite interesting that shortly after that, he's appearing on Iran's state broadcaster. So I guess you see... the most interesting thing for me in all of this really is almost these like weird ideological networks that seemingly shouldn't work together but do.
But they appear on the same TV channel?
Exactly, because I guess ultimately they do have the same immediate, you know, goals, but then once that gets achieved, it's all bets are off. A lot more straightforward was the BBC's take on the situation. I couldn't find any sort of equivalent debate-type program, so I just... pulled off something of their politics header describing the situation.
When Iran seized a British-flagged tanker on Friday, the 19th of July, it might have seemed like a surprise move, but it really wasn't. Here's why. 2 weeks earlier, off Gibraltar, the boot was on the other foot. British Royal Marines were the ones doing the boarding. This tanker, Grace One, was full of Iranian oil. Iran was furious. It vowed to retaliate.
من به انگلیسی‌ها میگم شما آغازگر ناامنی هستید و باید تبعاتش رو بعداً بفهمید و درک کنید.
And a week later it actually tried, sending fast boats out to try and force this tanker, British Heritage, into Iranian waters. But a Royal Navy frigate, HMS Montrose, was nearby. The Iranians had to back off. The Stena Impero was less fortunate. It was passing through the Strait of Hormuz when Iranian Revolutionary Guards boarded it and forced it to turn north into Iranian waters. HMS Montrose tried to intervene, but this time was too far away to stop it.
You are ordered change your course to 360 degrees immediately. If you obey, you will be safe, over.
This British-flagged, Swedish-owned tanker and its multinational crew from India, Russia, Latvia and the Philippines are now being held at the Iranian port of Bandar Abbas. And why is all this happening now? Well, for the past year, tensions have been rising following Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from a nuclear deal struck between Iran and world powers back in 2015, before Mr. Trump came to power. He wants the world to take a much tougher stance on Iran, and he's been turning the screws for the past year, imposing crippling new sanctions on Tehran, especially on its vital oil exports, which have plummeted. Iran says if it can't export its oil through the Straits of Hormuz, no one can. That's why it's suspected of attacking international tankers in May and June. It also shot down an American surveillance drone, which almost triggered an American military response. It's fair to say the Gulf is on a knife edge. Remember that tanker off Gibraltar? People wondered if Britain was doing Donald Trump's bidding, preventing Iran from exporting its oil. But the government in London says the Grace One was smuggling oil to Syria in breach of entirely separate EU sanctions on President Assad. It said it had no choice but to act. So there we have it, two tankers being held in the middle of a fierce, complicated geopolitical row.
And that was Ben talking about the latest situation in the Middle East on Neutral Corner. Ko te waia tēnei marunga BFM. We'll be right back after a break. You on BFM.
In New Zealand for the first time, Fred Armisen, Friday, September 6th at Sky City Theatre, star of Portlandia, SNL. Oh, I know who he is. Oh, yeah. Star of Portlandia, SNL alum, Late Night with Seth Meyers band leader, the incomparable Fred Armisen is bringing his show, Comedy for Musicians But Everyone is Welcome, to Auckland for one night only. Don't miss Fred Armisen, Friday, September 6th at Sky City Theatre. Get your tickets now from Ticketek.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Citizens, to this day in history with Benjamin J. Goldson.
Right, so we are at this day in history, and we are going to South Vietnam in 1964.
Indeed, Justin, for the Gulf of Tonkin incident. This was sort of the inciting incident, which was later found to have been sort of not faked, but sort of actually more provoked by America than they claimed to, which then served as the pretext for their direct involvement in the Vietnam War. So this conflict had been going really since the end of World War II. Mm-hmm. You'd had the old French Empire fighting against the Viet Minh, which is the sort of local nationalist, sort of left-wing nationalist, whatever you want to call
communists.
Them. Communists. Yeah, they weren't. Yeah. They didn't declare themselves as communists quite then. It was like they were more of a left-wing nationalist, but they did have a sizable communist cadre element, which obviously meant the Americans were very hostile to them and would support the French up until their famous defeat at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu.
As the fateful Geneva Conference approaches, Reds throw everything they have at supply lines leading to Dien Bien Phu, which has become symbolic of the outcome of the war in Indochina. The Haiphong-Hanoi Road is mine. Hanoi and the seaport town of Haiphong form a vital air-sea link to the beleaguered garrison, which has now withstood more than a month of siege. Wounded men and damaged equipment are the daily toll, as the Reds hammer incessantly at the artery which is keeping Dien Bien Phu in the fight. Not only is the road under attack, but the paralleling rail line is mined nightly in a desperate but vain effort to knock out the supply route, which may spell victory or defeat for the gallant French defenders, and which may have an important psychological effect on the conclusions reached at the forthcoming parley at Geneva. Herculean efforts keep the railroad in commission as labor battalions toil round the clock to keep rolling stock moving. With the fate of Southeast Asia in the balance, the battle of supply must be won.
Well, on the Battle of Sipai would be lost by the French, who would have to pull out of Indochina. In the aftermath of the Geneva Accords, Vietnam would be divided into North and South, the North being the sort of Viet Minh, more communist side.
Led by Ho Chi Minh himself.
Indeed. And the South being more pro-American. They would become increasingly sort of notorious for their corruption and brutality. However, despite all of this, they would still be strongly supported by the United States.
Meanwhile, in Saigon, capital of Laos's neighbor, South Vietnam, Vice President Lyndon Johnson pursues his fact-finding tour for President Kennedy. He announces an eight-point program for U.S. aid to this strategic and highly vulnerable nation. A program that includes arms and money to meet communist guerrilla threats and improve social conditions. Manila continues the warm reception of the Vice President. And he continues his informal Texas style, mingling with the welcoming crowds. Through such grassroots contacts, as well as through searching talks with the heads of governments in southeastern Asia, Mr. Johnson, now watching Filipino maneuvers, seeks information that may be a factor in Washington's decision for or against a meeting of President Kennedy with Nikita Khrushchev.
And so after the death of President Kennedy, the America's involvement in Vietnam, South Vietnam, would continue to escalate. Up until this point, technically, they weren't fighting. They had military advisors in country, which was probably a lie. They probably were to a degree doing fighting, but just not to the extent that they later would after these military advisors were replaced.
It's been a long time since such jolly pictures have come from South Vietnam, but these men have reason to grin. They're boarding Air Force jets to fly back to the States to home and Christmas. The Defense Department doesn't call this Operation Santa Claus or Reindeer or anything whimsical. They call it Operation Cutback, for it means more than just Christmas leave. It means the beginning of permanent reduction of American servicemen in this still strife-torn country. 220 happy soldiers, sailors, and flyers are in the first homebound flights. By Christmas, 1,000 will have shipped out, which is the maximum cutback planned at present. And speaking of presents, there's none better than home for Christmas.
Yes, and that was newsreel footage about the return of American military advisors from South Vietnam. And like I said, technically, they didn't have any direct engagement in the war. However, this would all change with the Gulf after the Gulf of Tonkin incident on this day in history, 1964.
Swift and sure has been U.S. retaliation for communist PT boat attacks on the high seas. This is the Maddox, one of the two destroyers that were attacked while patrolling international waters in the Gulf of Tonkin near North Vietnam. Warplanes from two carriers, the Ticonderoga and the Constellation, avenged the unwarranted Red Assault with 64 sorties to North Vietnam PT bases. 25 boats, more than half the fleet, were destroyed, and North Vietnam oil reserves badly depleted. It is estimated 10% went up in flames after direct hits. The Pentagon said two pilots were lost. One was reported to be a prisoner of the Reds. The U.S. sorties were launched for one purpose, as a warning to the communists that unprovoked attacks will bring prompt response. The lights burned all night in the White House as President Johnson conferred with his advisors, and he went before the nation to report on the crisis.
In the larger sense, this new act of aggression aimed directly at our own forces again brings home to all of us in the United States the importance of the struggle for peace and security in Southeast Asia. Aggression by terror against the peaceful villagers of South Vietnam has now been joined by open aggression on the high seas against the United States of America.
Before this new Southeast Asia crisis, the United States had announced that 5,000 more military advisors were being sent to South Vietnam to bring our forces there to 21,000. Now this number will be increased even further. At sea, on land, and in the air, the awesome United States military machine is mounting a force that can face up to any threat. In the field, the communist Viet Cong rebels appear to be stronger in recent weeks. They have made hit-and-run raids within 4 miles of Saigon, center of U.S. and South Vietnam operations. There are reports of an enemy troop buildup on the South Vietnam northern border. Now it appears that for the first time, there is talk of a South Vietnam drive into North Vietnam. Reinforcements are being moved into strategic locations as part of a new strategy in this frustrating war. This is not to force a showdown with the Reds, but to emphasize the U.S. wish to contain the war. Interceptor and fighter-bomber aircraft are being flown into South Vietnam and Thailand rapidly, as other air squadrons are transferred from the United States to advanced bases in the Pacific. As always, political differences faded in the United States, and leaders of both parties united behind the president to grant him all powers necessary to carry out our commitments to defend world peace.
It is a solemn responsibility to have to order even limited military action by forces whose overall strength is as vast and as awesome as those of the United States of America. But it is my considered conviction, shared throughout your government, that firmness in the right is indispensable today for peace. That firmness will always be measured. Its mission is peace.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for today after Ben's description of the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964. Thank you to everyone who tuned in today. Thanks to Ben for holding the fort with me and to Denise Lee for talking to me today. And obviously, last but not least, a big thank you to our news director, Lillian Hanley. Up next, it's the Land of the Good Groove with Murray. In the meantime, I'm going to leave you with Hope by Alex G. Stay dry, stay healthy, and until next time, have a good weekend. Ma te wa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.